The warm air, the sounds of baseball, it's got you thinking about hitting the road. And no matter where your adventures take you, Subaru of Gwinnett has a vehicle to get you there safely and in style. Like the 2024 Subaru Outback, sporting standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 32 miles per gallon. Or the 2024 Subaru Forester, the SUV with a spacious and comfortable interior for everyone you want to bring along. Start your shopping online at SubaruofGwinnett.com, then come see us for a test drive on Satellite Boulevard in Duluth.
In the South, it's always college football season, and the king of college football reigns supreme all year long. Southern Sports Today proudly presents The Chuck Oliver Show. It's an inside look at everything college football. Now live from Atlanta, Georgia, it's time to talk college football with the reigning king of college football, Chuck Oliver, on Southern Sports Today.
And a good Friday to you. Hello there. How's it going? It is Chuck Oliver Show. Heath Klein in for Chuck today. Chuck, maybe would have liked to have been here, I'm sure, but things don't always work out the way that you plan, and so Chuck will be back, I promise. The plan is for him to be back in the saddle on Monday. In the meantime, you and I can hang out, and we can talk some college football, and of course talk some about the ramifications from last night for the NFL draft for college football, because we are in a really interesting time, and I know there are some of you who listen to this show who don't like the NFL. Some people, maybe for political reasons in the last decade or so, got turned off by the NFL, but there's also people, even if that's not your stance, there's just some people that just never really got into the pro game. They like their college team. It's their town or their school that they went to, and they root for their home thing, and they don't feel a connection to any pro team in particular. And even when I worked in Columbia, South Carolina for about 15 years, there were people there that didn't really care for the pros, didn't care for the Panthers, even though the Panthers really market hard to that state, didn't care for them. Even Gamecock kids that went pro, they say, yeah, I hope he does well. I wish him the best. I'm just not going to be watching. So if you're one of those people, we're not going to turn today's show into any kind of an NFL draft review. You have my word on that. We're not going to do that. There's plenty of places you can hear about, you know, who reached for a pick or what. We're not going to do that. But regardless of whether or not you are a college and pro fan or just a college fan, what happens in the pro draft still has enormous ramifications for college. One thing in particular that is a trend that has been consistent and will continue to only grow is that the SEC is far better than any other conference, year in, year out, at generating players for the NFL draft. The Big Ten last night had 4 first-round picks. The SEC had 11. The SEC will win in the overall numbers, too, but in the premium picks, the best of the best, the SEC had 11. And that is not including the schools that have not joined the SEC yet. So next year, Texas and Oklahoma get added into that mix. Texas last night, multiple first-rounders, that's not included in the SEC total, because last night, the conference that actually did the second best of anybody in college football at generating first-round picks was the Pac-12. Pac-12 had 8 last night, going out on a high note in the Pac-12. None of those credited to the folks from Washington State that are going to be part of the Pac-2. But as a group, last night the Pac-12 did better actually than the Big Ten. As long as the SEC is considered the pipeline to get to the highest draft spots, your school in this conference will always have a better chance to succeed in landing talent than schools that are not in this conference. Now, does that mean that Mississippi State is going to out-recruit, say, North Carolina just because they're in the SEC and a North Carolina at the moment is not? No, I'm not saying that. But if it's close, the fact that the SEC year in, year out has shown, even against the other supposed mega conference right now, that they are better at producing premium NFL talent, that when you come to this conference, you will play against the best and you will get a level of exposure that will enhance your chances of getting every scout's attention in a way that some places might not. As long as that continues to be true, and boy, it's hard to imagine a reason it'll change, then the SEC is ahead of everybody else in the most important thing, landing talent. The other part of the equation that I thought was interesting last night involved Texas, actually. When we talk about this conference, and we talk about the new schools coming into this conference, the perception is that Texas is the program right now that kind of has its act together, and Oklahoma may, but there's more questions about Oklahoma. We touched on this yesterday with Jana Bardal from The Athletic. There are more people who kind of look at Oklahoma and say, well, let's wait and see about you. Texas is going to probably be voted when we go to, well, Texas for the SEC Media Days this year. Texas is probably going to be voted as the second best team in the conference. I think Georgia will still get the benefit of the doubt from everybody, and they should. But I think that the team that will be voted as the number two team in the conference and the team that would therefore play in the SEC title game, I think it's going to be Texas in year one. Part of that will be that we are in Texas. There will be a lot more media from Texas at the SEC Media Days this year than there will be media from some outlets that would have typically been at SEC Media Days if we're in Nashville like last year, or Alabama or Georgia, where you've had this event basically the entire time it's existed. This is way off the beaten path, and there's going to be some places that do not send their reporters to Dallas because it's too expensive. And obviously for Texas reporters, it'll be pretty easy. So that combined with the overall expectations for Texas, I expect Texas to be voted with Georgia 1-2 as the teams that will play in the SEC title game. Last night, Texas had two first-round picks. Murphy, Xavier Worthy, they go first round, one guy from defense, one guy from offense. Do you know how long it has been since Texas had two first-round picks? 2007. 17 years between Texas having two first-round picks in an NFL draft. That is not a program with the level of hype that the talent that goes there consistently gets. That is not a program that should have 17-year deficits. And yet, they did. Keep in mind, in that window, they actually played for a national championship during that window. They were recruiting high-end talent, and that includes, again, about 5 years or 6 years of Mack Brown there. They were recruiting high-end talent. They just weren't developing the high-end talent. Steve Sarkisian, in his entire career, has never demonstrated an ability to have any kind of consistency. Last year, they had some real close calls, but they overcame them. Will they finally have enough talent and develop the talent to the point that he finds a level of consistency he has never shown in his whole career? And will he be able to have that heightened level of consistency in an SEC that has fewer spots where you can overwhelm with sheer talent the way that they did in the Big 12 a lot of times? I will be fascinated to see what this year looks like for Texas. I'm not pro-Texas, I'm not anti-Texas, but brother, I am interested in Texas. This year is going to be fascinating. Watching them deal with the expectations. What if maybe Quinn Ewers gets off to a slow start? Will the fans be patient? Or will the fans say, we all saw what Arch can do. Get him in there. Stop wasting time. Let's go. Do you have a quarterback controversy? If you do, do we know that Steve Sarkisian knows how to handle a locker room if there's a quarterback controversy? I mean, there's just a lot of things that are going to be real interesting about Texas. But think about that. Think about the number of SEC programs that don't get anywhere near the level of exposure for their recruiting that Texas gets, that have still found a way to have two first-round picks in a year since 2007. That Texas program is either going to take full advantage of the opportunities and the resources the SEC creates for them and turn into what it's always been supposed to be. People have expected that program to be a monster for decades. Go back and look at them, though. How often have they actually come remotely close to living up to what people should be since Daryl Royal? Daryl Royal was a heck of a coach. Daryl Royal was a long time ago. And through all these different guys who were supposed to solve the puzzle, whether it was Fred Akers or David McWilliams or John Makovic, I mean, listen to some of those names and say, really? That's who was the coach of Texas? They finally got it together with Mack Brown. But even Mack Brown, go back and look at how many Big 12 titles they won. Wasn't many. Texas on paper should be amazing every year. It's the university of a giant state that cares passionately about football. It is located in one of the spots that is considered one of the coolest cities in the country to live in. How do you not have a dominant program there? And yet they haven't. Last night, finally, two first rounders. Again, it could have easily missed. I mean, Xavier Worthy was pick 28. It's not like he was a lock. They could have gone another year without it. Texas will be good. I just don't know if Texas will be great. And the expectations for Texas and the SEC, especially in first year, are going to be much more about great than good. But again, last night, 11 first-rounders for the SEC. The other thing that stood out last night, I think, that was interesting particularly is about transfers. We've had a lot of people wondering about the impact of transfers and what is that going to do to individual players with regards to their chances of developing for the National Football League. Are guys going to consistently transfer to places and get more exposure and do better? Are guys going to not be patient and not give themselves time to fit in, and so they just keep jumping around for the bag and they never live up to their full potential? Maybe it'll be a little bit of both. Probably, in fact, it'll be a little bit of both. For what it's worth, last night in the first round, 9 guys that were drafted last night were transfers. Now, that number will probably go up over the next couple of years because the portal has obviously gotten even more wide open than it was even a year ago. So now that you can transfer as many times as you want with no risk of consequence, now that schools can pretty much throw the bag out there right on the front yard rather than having to have any degree of subtlety about it, that number will probably go up. But at least last night, of the 9 guys that were in the transfer, you had 6 of the 9 guys that were in the transfer that left for the reason that guys have always left for: coaching changes. Guys that said, either one, I came to play for this coach, he's not here anymore, or maybe I want to follow this coach along the way. So a guy like a Michael Penix, for example, Michael Penix transferred very specifically to get back with Kalen DeBoer in Washington. He didn't follow him to Fresno State, but when Kalen DeBoer became the head coach of Washington, Penix said, I did good things with this guy at Indiana. Without him at Indiana, not so much. I want to get back together with a guy who's already coached me. Those kind of transfers are very different than transfers that are happening just because somebody somewhere offered a big bag of money. There will be more of those kind of guys. But last night, you look at it, 6 of the 9 were largely tied into coaching moves. Then you also had one player who was literally told, you can't play here anymore. Latu wound up being the first player that was drafted on the defensive side of the ball, but because of a neck injury, had been told by Washington, we can't clear you. You can't even play anymore. So he would have probably never left if they hadn't told him medically, we can't allow you to play. So you're talking about really only two players that you could just say they moved on for other reasons. And even one of those, you're talking about Jared Verse going from FCS to FSU. I mean, who would have ever knocked him for that? So at least right now, the model of how do you get to the league still is largely be recruited out of high school and then play for a coach or a system that's a good fit for you that you chose out of high school, have success there, and the NFL likes you. I think that number will change, but I did think that it was interesting that last night, a guy, for example, like a Keon Coleman does not go in the first round last night. I'm not saying it's because he transferred, but a guy who transferred last year more for reasons of, all right, there's financial opportunity for me, I'm leaving Michigan State and going somewhere where I can take advantage of it. A guy like that does not go first round. The guys that went last night, almost all were guys that the reasons that they transferred were pretty clear, and it wasn't just, hey, somebody dropped a bag. I think that's noteworthy, although, again, there's some trends that will probably evolve us away from it. So we will continue to talk about some of the things from last night's NFL draft. There's a lot more to get into. About 15 minutes, we'll look ahead for some of the players who didn't get selected. What does it say for them? What might be their opportunities? What about some of the guys who did find homes? last night. We'll talk about all that with Ian Cummings coming up in about 15 minutes. And then as we go this afternoon, too, check in with folks that I think you will find interesting on Florida and also on the national coaching scene. So it's going to be a fun day here on the Chuck Oliver Show. Heath in for Chuck today. Thanks for hanging out with us. We'll be right back.
Catch the king of college football no matter where you go with a new Southern Sports Today app. Catch the best college football conversation in the South everywhere with the SST live stream and daily podcast. Download it now at the App Store and the Google Play Store. Now more of the best college football talk in the country. It's the Chuck Oliver Show.
Chuck Oliver Show rolls on here on a Friday. Heath in for Chuck today. Thank you for hanging out with us, talking some college football on a Friday. By the way, we were just talking in the starting point there about transfers and about, despite all the attention that has been placed on extra movement in college sports compared to what we were all used to, that at least at the moment, it still looks like the best chance you have to get to the NFL's first round is go somewhere, develop there with the coaches if they stay the whole time, the coaches who brought you in, the system who brought you in, the teammates you have familiarity with, that you, at least for the moment, still seem to do better that way than you do if you're somebody who's jumping around. But there is absolutely an example also from last night and really over the last couple of years that drives home why it is a very good thing that players do have the ability to press reset if they need to. I feel like we've touched on this occasionally on the show, but it bears repeating. Herm Edwards, the fact that that man was hired as coach at Arizona State was kind of mystifying to begin with. You were talking about somebody who had not worked in college coaching in decades. You were talking about somebody who was no longer even considered a prospect for an NFL coaching role at the time he was hired. The idea at Arizona State, where, remember, his former agent was the athletics director. It wasn't like this was a lengthy search that Edwards put his name in for and really wanted the job and fought for it. It was him reaching out to an old buddy, him saying, hey, Herm, we could get the band back together here in Tempe, and you could be the head coach, again, of a program, and you could be the front man. That was the idea, that Herm Edwards would be the motivator and the recruiter and the public face of the program, and that you could let coaches handle the other stuff. In fact, if you remember, Billy Napier, who had been the offensive coordinator at Arizona State, that was part of the whole deal, was that, oh, we're just going to keep Billy Napier as coordinator, so, you know, Herm Edwards will come in from the outside, but we can keep the same offense from the previous staff. We like that offense. We can keep that same offense, and Herm can just sort of be, you know, recruiter, press conference guy. Except for it didn't work out that way because Billy Napier got the Louisiana job and got out of there, and Edwards had a bunch of different issues with his staff along the way. And of course, just this past week, Arizona State got hit with a bunch of different coaches getting show causes, including Herm Edwards, as if there's anybody who's ever going to hire Herm Edwards to coach college football again. But a bunch of coaches from the Edwards era got hit with show cause penalties. And people at Arizona State are asking, quite rightly so, why in the world did we pay this man who was involved in the staff that was heavily duty cheating? I mean, we're talking about serious level cheating here during the COVID era in particular. Why in the world did we pay this man a nickel to leave? Why do we pay him a buyout? Well, again, it's his old buddy, his agent, that was hooking him up. Not necessarily the best interests of your school, but the best interests of his friend. That's your answer. But what about the on-field stuff? Arizona State had the following players together on one roster. Jaden Daniels, a future Heisman-winning quarterback, number two overall pick in the draft. Ricky Pearsall, wide receiver, first-round pick last night in the draft coming out of Florida, 31st pick overall. Brandon Ayuk, who's been in the NFL already for years, was a part of that Arizona State era. He did not wind up transferring. Pearsall obviously left. Daniels left. Johnny Wilson, we'll see where he goes. Star receiver, though, for FSU, multiple years. Rashad White in the NFL as a former third-round pick already. And Keel Harry, guy who was a first-round pick. They had so much talent at that school. Some of it stayed, some of it left, but they squandered it all. It's just amazing. I mean, my goodness, a guy like Ricky Pearsall, does anybody think that Ricky Pearsall would have had the success that he had had he stayed at Arizona State and just taken his chances? I've always said Arizona State is a program that has fantastic possibilities. With the right coach, you should be able to bring in plenty of good talent, and it looks like they did. But you still have to be able to then do something with the talent once you get them there, and that's where the staff just did not do that with any kind of consistency. And so fortunately for players like Jaden Daniels and Ricky Pearsall, they were able to say, I have to go somewhere else. I need to do it. Now, again, if Herm Edwards had not been pushed out, maybe out of loyalty to the previous staff, maybe they stick around. And maybe they'd still be first rounders. But boy, it doesn't look like it. I mean, you can see for yourself what Jaden Daniels looked like at Arizona State and what he looks like now. And it's really hard to imagine that same development curve happens if he stayed there. Who knows through the years how many players there are that are the equivalent of those names at Arizona State that we never heard of as what they could have been as pros because they didn't have a transfer portal, because they didn't have the option to go somewhere else, find their Florida or their LSU and get themselves into the first round, find their FSU and get more opportunities on the field, and we'll see what you turn into, but certainly more than you were doing at Arizona State. How many kids through the years have gotten wasted by coaches with staffs that were just as inept as the one that Arizona State had put together under Herm Edwards, and they didn't have that safety valve? Like I say, maybe Ricky Pearsall would have stayed. We'll never know. But he had the option, he took it, and it worked out really, really well. And I feel bad because there's a lot of kids through the years you could point to that had they not had to sit out a year, had coaches not been able to put restrictions on them where they couldn't go to any school on their schedule or any school in the conference or any school, the coach just said, nah, I don't want to let you go. Had they not had that, maybe they could have gone and done better for themselves. Arizona State is the cautionary tale and also the happy ending.
The warm air, the sounds of baseball, it's got you thinking about hitting the road. And no matter where your adventures take you, Subaru of Gwinnett has a vehicle to get you there safely and in style. Like the 2024 Subaru Outback, sporting standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 32 miles per gallon. Or the 2024 Subaru Forester, the SUV with a spacious and comfortable interior for everyone you want to bring along. Start your shopping online at SubaruofGwinnett.com, then come see us for a test drive on Satellite Boulevard in Duluth.
The winningest team in baseball also has the most saves, and people who save the most money are winners. So start earning saves by investing in Worthy Bonds for only $10 each. These bonds earn a fixed 7% APY, and there's no fees, penalties, or minimum balance required, and they can be redeemed whenever you like. You can even round up everyday purchases to buy additional bonds. Go to worthybonds.com/save. That's worthybonds.com/save, and save and win.
Now more college football talk with the king of college football. It's the Chuck Oliver Show on Southern Sports Today.
Chuck Oliver Show continues. Heath Klein in for Chuck today. And again, a lot of different things that are going on. But for sure, whether you are involved in football in the college level, the pro level, what happens with the NFL draft matters to you. And so he said, let's check in with one of our guys that we rely on to keep an eye on the NFL draft for Pro Football Network. It is Ian Cummings. He joins us now here on the Dunkin' Donuts Newsmaker line. Ian, how are you, man?
Doing good, doing good. We got a full first round to kind of recap, so that's fun. For months and months on end, we were speculating about what might happen. Now we can finally review what actually happened. So there's a bit of refreshment that comes with that.
Everyone who pays any attention knows that mock drafts are a fool's errand at best, because all it takes, as soon as one team does something they're not supposed to do, then the dominoes all fall. It becomes basically impossible to correctly match players with picks in most of the spots. Now, what you can do is you can be right on, okay, this team needs a D end, and maybe it wasn't the D end that was available at the time that they took him, but this team needs a D end, and so you know, you're right about the position, but you might not be right about the guy. I'm curious for you, as somebody who's probably had to grind out a zillion of these things, how'd you feel about your night last night?
You know, I had some hits, I had some misses for sure. You know, I think the best thing about the mock draft, right, it is kind of meaningless at the end of the day because we don't know what's going to happen. But my stance on mock drafts and why they will always be valuable is not for predictive reasons, right? We're not trying to predict exactly what's going to happen to a T. We're just trying to explore different outcomes. So there were some things that happened that were maybe against the grain that you could be prepared for because you could read all the tea leaves. I think the Chargers picking Joe Alt at number 5, a lot of people had them featured as a potential trade down candidate, but they stay put, took him. And a lot of mock drafts had the Titans taking Alt because they thought he would get there. And then he ended up not being there, so they take J.C. Latham. So it's just, that's a representation of how the dominoes can fall and how early those things can happen. But in general, I thought I did okay. I had some hits and misses. But, you know, the NFL draft will always surprise you a little bit. Penix going at number 8, for example. I don't think anyone had that on their bingo card. So you just kind of roll with the punches. You take what you can get, and you just kind of move on to the next one.
Yeah, I just imagine guys like you that have had to work so hard at this, and then, like, the Jets are at pick 10, and a lot of people have them with Brock Bowers. I don't know if you did or not in your last mock, but that was one of the popular picks for them. I just imagine people like, no, no, you idiots, don't trade. No, you're ruining everything. Frustration all the way around because it's so much effort people put into these mocks, even though you know it's kind of a fool's errand. I know how hard you guys have to work at them because they generate lots of responses and content. Out of last night, I was talking about some of the things that jumped out to me, Ian, but I'm curious for you. Looking at it from a college perspective, what would be the stories? The SEC having the most first-round picks, again, is not probably a surprise. I wonder if there's some people who are surprised, though, that number 2 is the conference that's disappearing.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the Pac-12 and all the quarterbacks, too. Caleb Williams, Michael Penix Jr., Bo Nix. I mean, that kind of representation is very impressive for a conference that, you know, didn't have a long-term future. And it's kind of puzzling why it wouldn't last, right? But at the same time, there are a lot of other aspects that go into that. But I guess you could say the Pac-12 is going out with a bang. You know, they got Penix at number 8, Rome Odunze at number 9, Troy Fitanu, who I had as a top 15 guy, going to Steelers at 20 as well. You know, a lot of impressive picks there. And then Jordan Morgan sneaking into the first round of the Packers at 25th. So that was a good storyline for sure. I think teams like, you know, a few other teams that were well represented, Texas had a couple guys. I just think in general, you know, the SEC is always going to be the dominant conference. But you're right. I mean, the Pac-12, they kind of proved, especially this past year, that is a talent hub. And even looking ahead to 2025, there are a few teams that have some talent left over that can continue to make noise. So I'm excited to see what the remnants can do. It's not going to be the same without the Pac-12, but it'll be fun to look back at it.
So last night we had 23 offensive players taken in the first 32 picks. That's 4 more than the biggest offensive first round in NFL history. And it wasn't just 23 of 32. It was the first 14 in a row were all offensive guys. There were definitely people who said, hey, we might not have a defensive player in the top 10. I think not having a defensive player until 15 probably surprised even some of you guys. Is this a broader trend? Has this sport shifted so much towards offense that this is just how it's going to be now? Because if so, that's an example of a trend that might factor on down into the college ranks too.
I think, you know, there's merit to it, for sure. You know, we're seeing the NFL and football in general being more oriented towards space-dominated players, right, on offense. Can you create on offense? Can you put the defense in the bind? If you can do that, then that's a very valuable thing. And I think, you know, yes, there's a trend, but I also think this class in particular was skewed pretty far toward the offensive side. You know, everyone was talking about that big three of wide receivers, Marvin Harrison Jr., Malik Nabers, Rome Odunze. Those were all top 10 guys. And at the wide receiver position, if they're top 10 guys, they're going top 10. And that's what happened, right? And then a lot of offensive tackle talent as well. And then contrasting on the defensive side of the ball, I don't think it's that this was a weak defensive class, but we saw it last year. You know, Will Anderson Jr. came out and the Texans traded up to get him at number 3. So when there is a prospect of that caliber, teams will make moves to get them. And I don't think it was a bad defensive class, but you look at Dallas Turner, Lyle Tulasi, Byron Murphy II, some of the first defenders off the board. I don't think any of them were in that tier that Jalen Carter and Will Anderson Jr. were last year. So I think that's where the dichotomy strikes. I think it's a combination of, you know, this class maybe a tier below last year's defensively, but then also just the mass influx of offensive talent. I think that kind of exacerbated the trend that you are talking about.
Ian Cummings with us. He is NFL draft analyst for Pro Football Network here on the Chuck Oliver Show. All right, so Ian, the quarterback situation, how much of this is a reflection on what they see as the quarterback pool for next year? There are some obvious names, whether it's Carson Beck, Quinn Ewers, maybe Shedeur Sanders. There's some names that get thrown around that might be first-rounders. But six quarterbacks in the first 12 picks, including a couple in Penix and Bo Nix that even a few weeks ago would have really stunned some people as first-rounders, much less top 12 first-rounders. How much of this is a reflection of just teams' desperation now? And how much of it is a reflection of them looking in the future and saying, I don't know that I like what the grocery looks like the next couple of years?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. I think as an evaluator, I've always learned a lot can change. You know, like we can look ahead and see what's going to happen. Like, you know, before this cycle, most people knew that Caleb Williams and Drake May were going to be top three picks. But then you go back a couple more. There was a cycle, I think it was before the 2022 NFL draft, where a lot of mock drafts in the summer, if you remember, had Spencer Rattler and Sam Howell going 1-2 overall, right? So, you know, a lot can change. A lot can stay the same. You don't really know what's going to happen. But, you know, seeing the way these guys rose, I think it's a number of things. I think some NFL teams obviously were a lot higher on Michael Penix Jr. in particular than the media was. I had him and Nix kind of in that 30 to 35 range. So I was a little bit lower, but it looks like some NFL teams were higher on those guys. So that played a role. But I'd be hard pressed to say it's not at least a little bit of a factor looking ahead and looking at how, I don't want to say sparse, because again, we don't know what it's going to have in a year. But right now, there is some uncertainty. I really like the reps that Carson Beck put on late in the year for Georgia. I think Shedeur Sanders does have talent for sure, but you don't have that same level of certainty where, you know, even with a guy like J.J. McCarthy, who maybe didn't reach the level as a prospect that you wanted him to, he came into Michigan right away and turned around that culture, helped, you know, build that culture, and helped win that championship. For that winning just in general and setting those things in motion is a very valuable thing for NFL evaluators and looking at the talent he has too, the youth, right? So, you know, I think it was a number of factors, but I do think it factors in a little bit, especially, you know, if you're Denver, if you're Atlanta, you know, Atlanta was the trickier one, right? Because I think they had time to wait for a succession plan if they wanted to. Denver was in a little bit tougher spot, but I do think there is some reflection there on the uncertainty next year.
We have seen a trend, obviously, in the recent drafts that teams took quarterbacks, maybe forced the issue to take quarterbacks. You go back, you look at 2021, you take a guy who has one season in FCS ball and one game in 2020 played against Central Arkansas, and you have a team trade multiple first-round picks and take him at number three, trying to force the issue to find a quarterback. And basically all of these quarterbacks from recent drafts are either at best an incomplete like a Bryce Young or are outright failures in most cases, with the only exception so far being a fantastic start for C.J. Stroud and Trevor Lawrence probably underachieving compared to what people made him out to be, but at least a solid NFL starter. Other than that, the last 3 years are either incompletes or total wipeouts. How is it that instead of learning from that, you're seeing teams double and even triple down on getting more aggressive about trying to force this issue early?
Yeah, well, you know, it's difficult, right? Because I think there's a lot of volatility that goes with the quarterback position, because naturally it's the position that's impacted by everything else on the field, offensive, defensive, right? You're blocking, your guys getting open, right? Defensively, with the rush getting to you a little quicker, the schematics, I think. And quarterbacks, you know, have to juggle so much in every given rep. There's a lot of room for fluctuation, for variation. I think that's where we see that in part, right? I think some guys like Justin Fields, you could tell he was talented, and there were instances earlier in his career where you're thinking maybe he can be the guy, but then sometimes they level out, right? You know, every single case is different. And even with Trevor Lawrence, I think there's an outcome where if the Jaguars don't fire Urban Meyer after that first year, he crashes into the ground, because as good of a prospect as he is, you need your supporting structure to be solid, and there's so many variables that impact the QB on every single given down. So, you know, the value of the QB position at the NFL level is that will always be an accelerant for that kind of stock, right? You're never going to see a draft where, you know, teams are saying, well, you know, maybe we can wait a little bit, you know, no, because it's that important. If you have a guy that you feel with conviction can be that elevating presence for you, you have to be aggressive to get him. And, you know, teams are going to continue to try and probably continue to fail a lot because of how valuable that is, right? So it's kind of a catch-22 because you never know, and there's so many different factors, but it's something you have to be aggressive for, because if you're not, someone else will be, and maybe they end up reaping the rewards.
Ian Cummings with us for a couple more minutes. Again, NFL draft analyst from ProFootballNetwork.com, kind of trying to make sense of round one and then look ahead. Stephen, one thing that we did see leading up to this draft is that the positions that actually in the last 20 years have most consistently performed from the first round have been mostly O-linemen, which is surprising to me because at one point it felt like the tackles in particular were real reaches, but center and guard are among the most safe positions you could draft in the first round. They're just not perceived maybe as valuable as some of these splashy positions that people want to try and get in the first round. Last night, we saw a good number of O-linemen go early. Has something changed here? Have teams begun to reevaluate that, you know what, we are having success with centers in the first round, for example, so let's take a couple? Are the colleges doing a better job of sending linemen up than maybe they were for a while there, where there was a perception with the air raid splits and whatnot, you weren't getting them ready for the NFL? What's changed here, if anything?
I think, you know, in part, this was just a strong O-line class. And we saw that come the end of the month leading up to the draft, you know, a lot of tackle talent, a lot of interior line talent as well. But, yeah, I think there is a little bit of a shift going on. I think people are starting to realize, and I think this has always been the case to a degree, but, you know, protecting the QB from interior pressure, right? Because the defensive tackles, those three techs, those one techs, they have the quickest path to the pocket, right? They have the quickest path outfield to the quarterback. And if they get disruption, if they knock that guy off the line, then that prevents the QB from stepping up in the pocket. That makes them uncomfortable. So a lot of people put the value on the edge rushers because sometimes they're rushing into that QB blind spot where he doesn't have the reaction time to, you know, adapt and evade. But I think interior pressure and protecting from interior pressure is just as valuable. So I do think we're starting to see that. And then just different run schemes, being able to pull, being able to hinge around on reach blocks, the versatility. Offensive linemen with that elite combination of athletic profile and, you know, the mentality, the intangibles, they always get inflated and moved up the board. But I think now the value of that interior, you know, protection is becoming more and more distinct. So I do think there is a little bit of a shift. There's always going to be, you know, an element of uncertainty and volatility each class because the grades are different. The grades are just different. This year's was a strong class, but I think you're also seeing that reflected the shift, the value of the interior offensive line.
So meanwhile, we have rounds 2 and 3 tonight. Still looks like there's a lot of good wide receiver talent on the board. Do teams start digging in? We had the last two picks of the first round be wide receivers. Do we see a big run on receivers, you think, early? Or given that there is so much talent, do teams say, yeah, we can still be patient here. We've got other needs we got to try and meet with spots that might have less talent to begin with?
It's a tough question. I think I'm looking at that 33 to 40 range, and you got the Bills right away. They traded down a couple spots. I think they have a big needed receiver that could take one right there. You've got the Patriots at 34 who just drafted Drake May, so you want to support him, right? Arizona could double up if they want to. They got Marvin Harrison Jr., but I think their other two guys are Michael Wilson and Greg Dortch, so they can upgrade that as well. The Commanders could be an option. The Chargers could be an option after taking Joe Alt in round one. So I think upwards of 5 or 6 of those first teams could have a wide receiver in mind. Now, a lot of wide receivers went off the board last night. So if you want to go wide receiver, you know, you're looking at the guys like Jalen Polk, like Keon Coleman, like Ladd McConkey, right? So the board is starting to thin out a little bit, but because it is, I think we could see teams be aggressive for those playmakers. So if I had to bet, if I was a betting man, I'm not, but if I was, I would say there could be a run on wide receivers pretty early in round 2.
Ian Cummings, you can check him out at ProFootballNetwork.com. You can follow him on Twitter. IC_draft is the handle there. Ian, appreciate you making some time for us during a busy window here for you here on the Chuck Oliver Show. Thanks, man.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Chuck.
There you go. There's a little bit of a look from the college perspective at some of what went down last night and what it might mean. By the way, you heard him mention Keon Coleman. You remember when FSU had the chance to go play in the Orange Bowl and basically the huge window of kids there said, yeah, I'm not going to play in the game so I can get ready for the draft? Didn't really turn out the way that maybe some of those guys thought they would, at least last night. I mean, look, maybe they're going to still do better than they would have had they not taken that time away. I do wonder, you never know with NFL teams how they decide to evaluate things like intangibles and what kind of a kid you're getting in your locker room and whatnot. I wonder if maybe at least some of those FSU players, teams looked at the way that they chose not to play in the bowl game as a group and just said, yeah, I don't know if these guys are necessarily coming in with the mindset that we're looking for. Maybe it's nothing. But to be willing to walk away and just let your team get destroyed by Georgia, not say, we're going to stick it to the NCAA. We're going to prove a point. We should have been in. We got completely ripped off. Our quarterback got hurt. It wasn't our fault. We got ripped off. We're going to go out there and we're going to try and put it on an SEC team and make everybody have to acknowledge that we should have been there. Instead, basically, we're mad. Screw this. We're gone. And at least last night, those guys who made that call did not hear their names called by Roger Goodell. Maybe it's something, maybe it's nothing, but it did get my attention. All right, we continue here on the Chuck Oliver Show.
Now back to Southern Sports Today and the Chuck Oliver Show.
You talk to people that cover the Big Ten, they'll tell you that the Big Ten tells everybody up there they have no interest in Florida State. A lot of people like to say that the SEC has no interest. Greg Sankey's made it clear he has no interest in expanding right now. I just know that these people here are very confident that they are going to have a home, and it's going to be in one of those two conferences. I still think it's going to be the SEC at the end of the day.
That is the voice of Ira Schoffel from War Chant. We've had Ira on the show. Ira's a sharp guy. It was him with the morning program on Jocks in Birmingham. And it's great that they believe that, but, I mean, at some point, don't you need to have some actual tangible evidence that this desire you have is reciprocated? Like, I mean, do me a favor, Dave, just let's listen to that again, because this is someone who, again, covers FSU on a day-in, day-out basis, who has been in journalism for a long time, and he is flat-out saying, yeah, you know, everybody from the two parties involved says no way, no how, but we got a feeling. It's just kind of weird.
If you talk to people that cover the Big Ten, they'll tell you that the Big Ten tells everybody up there they have no interest in Florida State. A lot of people like to say that the SEC has no interest. Greg Sankey's made it clear he has no interest in expanding right now. I just know that these people here are very confident that they are going to have a home, and it's going to be in one of those two conferences. I still think it's going to be the SEC at the end of the day.
I mean, yeah, people up there, nope. Everybody down here, nope. But they're confident. I mean, I don't know, man. The SEC, at the moment, has no reason to benefit from adding FSU. I don't know if there's some sort of scenario somewhere down the line where it would seem like it would be a benefit. But whether it's FSU, whether it's Clemson, it adds nothing that is worth adding another person to get a check. It's just not. FSU and Clemson do not move the meter enough in any meaningful way to where you need to cut them in on new pieces of the money. They don't. FSU has people nationally who are interested in FSU football. It does not have a massive national alumni base compared to lots of other schools that are out there. It does not have a consistent following in any sport but football nationally. They have some other sports that they are excellent in, but it's not like you say, well, and also FSU basketball brings eyeballs to a package. No, they don't. FSU baseball has been good historically, but again, no one's making these decisions based on your other sports. There's no reason for the FSU-SEC marriage to ever happen. And same thing's true for Clemson. Again, you've already got the team in state. Clemson is a school that, while they had success in basketball this year, again, their primary sport that they do anything in that people pay attention to is football. They are not consistently any kind of basketball program. Good in soccer, good in baseball right now. None of that stuff matters. Not a major national alumni base. Not a major national fan base. Don't move a ton of merchandise. Like, what reasons does the SEC have to add either of those two? Oh, you got to keep them away from the Big Ten. Can't let the Big Ten get a footprint in the SEC. Does anybody think, anybody, that Clemson and that school and their culture feels like a fit for the Big Ten? There are already programs in that conference that are saying, we don't want any more, period. We didn't want even the Washington-Oregon thing. We didn't want Fox paid for it. We didn't want that. We still want to play games in the Midwest against Midwestern teams. We don't want to travel all over the universe in a conference. Now, when the conferences are going away, when that's the thing, when we're just going to some sort of 20 Northern teams, 20 Southern teams, NFC, AFC version of college football, that's a different deal. But as long as we are operating under the premise that the conferences still exist, I don't see why either one really benefits from FSU or Clemson all that much. And I sure don't see Clemson. FSU, by virtue of Florida and all the Midwestern people in Florida, you can at least sell me that maybe despite the fact that FSU is not in the AAU and that the culture doesn't feel like a particularly great fit with most of those schools in the Big Ten, you could sell me that they think there's an opening in Florida for them. You can never sell me Clemson to the Big Ten. I'm sorry. I don't care. You're never going to get me to buy in. I'll have to see them play a game in the Big Ten before I'll believe it. They could announce it and I won't believe it until I see Clemson running onto the field for their conference game with the Golden Gophers or something. But man, they'll just tell anybody, listen, oh, it's going to happen. We got a feeling. They better be right about that feeling.
The warm air, the sounds of baseball, it's got you thinking about hitting the road. And no matter where your adventures take you, Subaru of Gwinnett has a vehicle to get you there safely and in style. Like the 2024 Subaru Outback, sporting standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 32 miles per gallon. Or the 2024 Subaru Forester, the SUV with a spacious and comfortable interior for everyone you want to bring along. Start your shopping online at SubaruofGwinnett.com, then come see us for a test drive on Satellite Boulevard in Duluth.
The winningest team in baseball also has the most saves, and people who save the most money are winners. So start earning saves by investing in Worthy Bonds for only $10 each. These bonds earn a fixed 7% APY, and there's no fees, penalties, or minimum balance required, and they can be redeemed whenever you like. You can even round up everyday purchases to buy additional bonds. Go to worthybonds.com/save. That's worthybonds.com/save, and save and win.
Spring is here and baseball is back.
You can't forget the Derby. I love the hats. Do you have yours yet?
My hat? I treated myself to a whole outfit.
If you want to be able to treat yourself, then you should check out the Nest Savings Account at LGE Community Credit Union, where they want you to reach your savings goals faster.
Take it from a pair of 680 The Fan wives. Head to lgeccu.org to find out what makes their team number one in Georgia.